on this particular path. And I want to begin really by looking at this image from the Waite-Smith pack, the image of the magician. Now, in a certain sense, this weekend and the next weekend, we're looking at the paths that are on opposite sides of the tree. So this is the path connecting Ketter to Bina. So connecting the non-dual awareness to the non-dual love that shapes and creates all form. The complementary path, which we look at next time, is the 11th path from Ketha to Hokmah, the path of the fool, which is the path from the formless awareness to the non-dual energy and will that seeds and generates the universe. And these two places, paths are connected then by the path that we looked at last time, the path between Hokmah and Bina, which is the path of the Empress. Now, obviously, when we're working at this level of the supernals, because all that the supernals appear at act at one at all times, it is non-dual. There's no separation. So whatever we say about one path, of course, has its reflection in each other. Nonetheless, it's useful just to get a degree of distinction between the way these different qualities of the deep spirit operate within us. Now, the movement really in this path is the movement out of this non-dual awareness of Ketter into that principle of love, infinite love, that shapes and forms and manifests, that creates the beloved child. The beloved child is whatever is created, whatever shape arises out of awareness. The Hebrew letter applied to this path is the letter Beit, which is the house. And it is the shape, the housing. So this fundamental, if we think of the idea of home and homelessness, and you think of the basic shelter that all living beings require in order to live, in order to grow, in order to manifest fully. The letter Beit, the little house is concerned with that, the creation of a shape within which life can flourish. So we can think of the house of our bodies, we can think of the house that we're sitting in, we can even think of the shape of a cell as being if you think of the single cell, it is a shape that enables the if you like, the fire and the will of the DNA to manifest in shape. The work of the magician, therefore, is the enabling of that life energy. The enabling of the creation of shape and form. The creation, in a certain sense, of icons that enable the non-dual will of Ketter, the awareness of the non-dual will of Hokmah, the awareness of Ketter to manifest within time and space in a moving, living, growing shape. And I'll talk about this as a particular issue in response to Fern's thing about the numbers, but using that idea of the numbers, Ketter is the one, is the singularity, it is the one point in space. Once you place a point into space, you create a definition, you create the singularity automatically, because if there's a point in the background of the point, it implies reflection, it implies duality. Duality, which is the energy of movement and reflection, which is the straight line, which is a continuous number of points, represents that sense of will and movement. We have the sense of the primal point and then the sense of movement. So then we have the relationship between the singularity and the movement that arises out of the singularity, which creates the third term. We have the point, the movement, the relationship between the point and the movement. This third term is this quality of shaping, this quality of relating, which is why love is the third principle. And it's from that quality of shaping and reflection back into both awareness and will that the dynamic of creation emerges. Now, the tarot card, the magician in the Waite-Smith pack, really shows, it's a symbolic stance, really, that shows, in a certain sense, that work of magic, that work of manifesting. If we look first at the image on your screen, the background is golden light. This is the classic background to any icon. Sometimes they use blue light, but the idea is of a golden radiance or an infinite radiance, infinite background. Because that is what stands behind the work of magic is the infinite light. And the Kabbalists describe this in three terms. They say there is the infinite light, Ein Sof Aur, the infinite light. The light that is infinite, that is just infinite, infinity, Ein Sof. And is also Ein, that is the no thing. So when we contemplate an image like the magician, when we pay attention to the background, we pay attention to what the Kabbalists would say is the unmanifest background to the universe. The infinite light, the infinity, the no thing out of which everything arises. Thomas Traherne has a lovely phrase where he talks about the shady nothing out of which the world is formed. Now, the magician represents that, first of all, just by being a figure in the foreground, and therefore creating the foreground and the background, in that very placement then is Keter, is the single point. In the stance of the magician, which is that upright stance holding this double-wanded white wand in the right hand and pointing up and down, is adopting the stance of Chokmah, the stance of movement, of the moving line of the air, what that image tells us, this is about an act of the manifestation of will. If we then consider that the magician is standing in a garden full of lilies and roses, a So what we're shown here is that infinite love, shaping love, that brings the universe into being as an act of love and delight. That sense of the divine as the lover, the beloved, creating the forms of the universe out of light and delighting in every form that is made. Delighting in our form, in all the forms around us, even the form of Donald Trump, even the form of that which appears unlovely to us. At some level, that shaping is delighted in by the divine, by that infinite quality of love. Above the head of the magician, we see the lemon's gate, the sign for infinity. Around the head of the magician, there is this white circlet, which again represents the white energy, white and infinite energy of Keter. So we're being shown here that what is happening here is the movement of the infinite into shaping, into form. The magician wears an inner robe of pure whiteness, pure white linen, which is this material that allows, semi-transparent material that allows the light to manifest. Over that there is the red robe, the robe of desire, and what we're looking at here is the holiness of desire, the goodness of desire, the desire that the world shall be. The divine looked upon the world and saw that it was good, tov, the goodness of creation. So here that, if you like, the purity of the inner light, the transparency of the inner light is wedded to the rosy, glowing redness of desire in a sacred marriage. Around the waist of the magician is the serpent biting its own tail. So we're with this sense of working with time. As we work with shaping, we work with time. We work with the repetition of cycles. In front of the magician is the altar table. And on the table are the four suits of the tarot, connected to the letters of the name. So we have the wand that's connected to the letter Yud, the cup connected to the letter He, the Vav connected to the sword, and the little pentacle, coin pentacle, connected to the He final. The Shin is, of course, the lemon's gate, the infinity coming in. The tabletop is the field of attention. So the stance of the magician is the embodiment of the deep will. The work of the magician is within the garden, working with the elements of the tarot pack, the Yud-He, Vav-He of the name, in order to embody the spirit. And in a certain sense, if we look at the way the garden is shaped, there's a little arbor of roses over the head. So there's a kind of a hidden shape in this card, because it's shaped like the letter Bet. So letter Bet. So if you look at the bottom of, if we look at the bottom and we look at the, that runs along there, and we go up the top of the card where the pointer is going, and then round to where this sort of dips down. Well, this is an approximation of the shape of the Hebrew letter Bet. And this is the house of the magician. So these are the elements, what's being shown in this card. These are the elements that constitute the house of the magician. This is the stance of the magician. These are the tools of the magician. And one of the things we need to remember in the Kabbalah, human beings are said to be Beit Zelihim, made in the image, made in the particular image of the divine. They are the house. So Beit Zelim means the house of the living image. So the human being, as the Zelim, as the image of the divine, are also the house of the divine. The container of that life and energy. And having the capacity of the divine to generate life. So this way in which human beings are creators, are generative, are aspects of the generative mystery that can, that continues to create and enable new life to come into being. So from that point of view, to in that sense, I suppose, all human beings, we could say, are magicians. Because they are constantly creating, recreating their world around them. Not always skillfully. Now, if we remember the Tree of Life, the whole journey that we have been looking at is the way of being able to open up our awareness to include more and more of who we are. At all points of the journey, we remain these creative beings that are generating life and presence and possibility around us. The problem when we're only aware of part of us is that we have only, because we're working with limited understanding and limited information, our creative abilities can go badly wrong. So for example, when we, if we're only really focusing on Yesod and Malkut, and even really not Malkut, mainly just Yesod, and really oscillating between Yesod and Netzach and Hod, which means really working with our own own sense of ourself, our own sense of the world, our own thoughts around that, our own feelings around that, without interruption. We create bubble worlds within ourselves that can be paranoid, that can be bizarre, that can have very little relationship even to the deeper aspects of ourselves. But because of the power of our creativity, it operates with that power. You know, if you think of things like school shootings that happen more in the States than here, fortunately. But if you think of the creativity, it's an odd word to use really to look into something as awful as this, but if you think of the creativity that has gone into that, the paranoid, the alienated creativity, the sense of the being outside everything, the sense of an enemy, the sense of something that needs to be destroyed, the ability then, not such a difficult thing in the States, but even so, it requires something to acquire guns, to acquire ammunition, to acquire a kind of, to create a plan, to carry out an awful plan. Now this is a Klipotic creativity. Now as we've looked at the Klipot, you know, the all the various Klipot have this sense of disturbance within them because they're operating out of separation. They're operating out of a limited and antagonistic view of the universe. You know, in place of the unity of the primal unity of Keter, they have the image of the Themael, the quarrelling heads, dedicated to eternal opposition. In place of the unity of the divine will, we have the Ogiel, the divine dementia. In place of the manifestation of the beauty and the glory of the universe, we have the Satariel hiding in shame. In place of the growth and the power of Hesed and the enormous growth, we have the empty, the eternal empty hole, the black hole that sucks everything in. In place of the clarity and the discipline of Gevurah, you have the burners and the destroyers that use their creativity to destroy. In place of the balance point of Tiferet, you have the tyrannical king who manifests the energies of the disturbed name, the name that disturbs and not instead of healing. In place of the beauty of the emotions and the quality of loving kindness that infuses emotion, you have Oreb Zab, the parasite, the energy that steals life. In place of the truth of the mind, the clarity of the mind, we have the lies and deceptions and seductions of Samael. In place of the purity and the power of sexuality and life force, we have the mixing up of energy, of things, the mixing up and the disturbance of invasion that we find. And then in place of the manifestation of life and growth in Malkut, we have Lilith, the night demon that kills life before it can emerge. Now all of that is obviously very disturbing, but it is all also a manifestation of a certain kind of separated creativity. It is the energy of the magician working from limited information, from limited places, from separated places. So when we embrace the name, when we embrace the quality of being the true magician, we bring the universe back together. We welcome in the lost. So it is truly the art, you know, the art of the magician. You find it in that psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd." You know, that sort of who goes into the valley of the shadow of death, who sets up a table, it's the table of the magician, who sets up the table in the face of the enemies, who welcomes in, back into the flow of life, all that has become separated. If we come back to the tarot card again, if we just look at the stance, the standing in the middle of the world, pointing up and pointing down. Establishing, if you like, the dimension of height and depth. Being the living pillar. Being the place where the infinite becomes finite. Through our human shape. Through, as we just let ourselves stand or feel that verticality of our body, we find this center line that connects between the depth and the height. But what we also discover is our three-dimensionality and our finiteness. And so what we're working with initially is that sense of the infinite coming into our shape, our form. Initially as the vertical pillar, but as we become the vertical pillar, we notice our front and our back, our left and our right. We become three-dimensional. We notice the passage of time. So as we enter into this shape, we enter into space, we occupy space. We notice the passage of time. We become present in space-time. We become aware of stillness and desire. We start to notice the place in which we stand, the place that is our house, the place that is our garden, our place, our world, our environment. We start to inhabit that. And as we retain that capacity of awareness and we retain this stance and this understanding of the infinite manifesting through our particular finiteness, we become aware of the table of work. That is our work, the place our attention is drawn to. We become aware of the tools of our work, of the will of the one, the letter Yud. That is that fiery will. We become aware of the shaping quality of our love and imagination in the cup. We become aware of the clarity and the potency of our mind to focus, to kill and make alive, to clear. You know, the sword image is a very important image. It is that capacity of the mind to make choices. To make any creative choice is to both make alive and to kill. Because with the sword, we clear out of the way all the things that should not be so that the one thing can live. So that sense of being able to say no, that sense of being able to defend against the infinite possibilities so that the one possibility can then emerge as the living coin, the final letter hey, that is the one thing that then emerges. So working with this principle of will, of love and imagination, the principle of transmission, which involves choice. So from the many possibilities that arise out of the conjunction of love and will, we choose a particular and focus, and in a certain sense inscribe into matter, into embodiment, that which needs to live through us, that aspect of the infinite that needs to arise in this moment. And having done that, we let it go. We return to the stance. Return to the mystery of the infinite and the finite, the mystery of beyond space and time and being in space and time. Now another image of the magician. Find it. Yeah. So this is the kind of image of the magician you find for them from the very early tarot packs, called the batulaque, or the waver, the one who holds the wand. And this is from one of the early Marseillais packs. Although it's kind of different, it doesn't have the precision of form. What you see is still this kind of the lemon's kid is still there in this kind of strange hat. He's holding the wand. He's got this sense of the separate colour, blocks of colour, which is a sense of opposites and union. And you have, of course, this table. Now, the interesting image about this early image is that it's also got the kind of, if you like, the shadow image of the trickster, the magician who, by sleight of hand, kind of fools us. And the image of the deep magician that we've just been looking at is actually an image of transparency, of no fooling, of things emerging. What this image holds is the potential for that, but also the potential in our own creativity, in our own practice of magic, to trick ourselves and to trick others. It's the art of the pickpocket, the art of misdirection. Now the thing that, you know, I really like stage magic, but stage magic is the absolute opposite of what we're talking about, because it's all based upon misdirection, upon confusing awareness and presenting an illusion as if it is real. The art of deep magic is the art of revealing truth, that which is true. The art of this kind of magic is misdirection, confusing awareness, so that what appears to be true is actually an illusion. Now, of course, we all have this. We are all, to a certain extent, aware and all deluded. So if you like, the two images of the magician, in a sense, that aspect that can confuse and trick us, and that which can liberate us, are really kind of important images in terms of our understanding of the deeper parts of our own nature. And it's sort of interesting if we consider the shadow aspect of this path. The, if you like, it stands between, if you like, Satariel, which is the ability to hide and conceal, and Thomael, which is the primal splitting. In a certain sense, that activity of illusion depends upon the splitting of awareness and the hiding of what is true. So it, in order to create the illusion of that which appears real but is not. You know, it's how the demagogues work. The world is full of demagogues at the moment who are using this quality of splitting and presenting something that is untrue as if it is true. You know, it's an art of mystification. And sadly, you know, God help us, there are plenty in the spiritual world that also do this. The world is full of people who mystify, who enjoy to mystify, who enjoy this idea of I know more than you do, and I let you know it so that I appear more powerful and therefore I am more persuasive towards you. The true art is this art. The work of Kabbalah is called the work of unification, of bringing together all the opposites. This name Yud He Shin Vav He, which we've worked out persistently through this whole period, is the unification of the universe. That's why it's called the healing name. The healing is in the connection. It's in the bringing together of that which is separated. And the holding of that which is separated, this which is finite, that which is scared, that which is lost, that which no longer knows its way, within this great field of golden light and love that is the infinite presence, that is the beloved, who is the active lover, seeking the good of all beings. This is the great, you know, Jesus' parable of the prodigal son shows this. The trouble with, you know, a lot of biblical sayings and stories is they are over familiar, or they're within a kind of context that separates them from their radical kind of nature. And in a certain sense, the parable of the prodigal son is one of these, because it's really an extraordinary story of resurrection, and of hope, and of saying, no matter how far you think you have wandered from goodness, from light, from peace, actually, in a moment, you can return. You know, the whole process, parable of the prodigal son is the son, once the son turns, there's one extraordinary phrase, the son turns and makes one step towards his father. His father takes 10 steps towards him and embraces him and places the robe of honor on him, kills the fatted calf, and there's this great celebration because he who has lost has returned. Now this is one of the great themes of Jesus' teaching. You know, no matter how lost, no matter how bad, everything can be healed, everything can be brought back together. But what is required to enable this is the turning back towards the light and the making of the one step. In Kabbalah, that is called teshuvah, the turning of the heart. In Christian tradition, it's called metanoia. It's the turning of the heart in the direction, not because the divine light will refuses you unless you do that, but because it is your will to turn away from the divine light that keeps the divine light away. If your will of refusal is laid down, even for a moment, that light surges forward. That return is accomplished in an instant. I just want to read you a little bit from my book, from the beginning of my book. The first bit, because it always come back to this, it always reminds me of, well, why do I do any of this? Some 35 years ago, when I was very much a fledgling Kabbalist, my wife and I visited a small church in the depths of Suffolk. It was a sunny day. The village was a classic English village with a duck pond, haven of peace and tranquility. An 11th century Norman church that looked beautiful in the afternoon sun. We'd anticipated a pleasant visit, looking at stained glass windows, tombs, learning a little bit about the history of the church. When we entered, we found what we would have expected to find, a plain, well-proportioned country church. But the psychic atmosphere hit us between the eyes. There was a sense of coldness, airlessness, and what I can only describe as fouled air. I recall stumbling in shock and surprise. I was near to the baptismal font, so I reached out in order to stabilize myself. As I did so, I was suddenly aware of the presence of a medieval priest holding me up and overshadowing me. I was given the strong impression that this place had been desecrated, and rather than a place of peace, was now a fountain of despair and anti-life. I found myself repeating the name Yud-Heh-Shin-Vav-Heh, which in our tradition is called the healing name. And as I did so, it was as if a fountain of pure water burst out of the font and flowed through the church. My wife stood with me and repeated the name with me. I don't know how long we stood there, as I was not in an ordinary state of mind, but gradually the sense of oppression lessened. However, rather than the experience fading away, it intensified. It was as if the priest stepped more deeply into me, and I leaned back into him and into the nave. I found myself walking up the nave to a 12th century tomb in the north chancel. And as I did so, there was a sense of another presence, as if rising out of the tomb. There was a different quality in the church now. An active will which engaged with and resisted the will that was coming through me. I found myself laying hands upon the tomb in a gesture of contact and blessing, even though it was coming from the tomb, was what I can only describe as pure antagonism. Again, I don't know how long I stood there. It was like standing in the epicenter of a great storm. As the light and the presence of the healing name coming from the priest and what seemed to be a great line of figures behind him, moved through me to be met by a dark shape of resistance. Gradually the resistance seemed to fade, and for a moment I caught a glimpse of a human being. Something gave way and the figure and I came together, were embraced by the light, and it was as if he passed through me into the light. In the aftermath, I was exhausted. There was peace, and certainly the church was an easier place to be in. This experience, though challenging and tiring, was in a strange way a profound demonstration of the nature of love, and embracing even that which rejects love. And in a way, that's the whole point of this deep magic, that actually to embrace even that which, with love, to embrace even that which resists love. You know, the great prayer of Judaism is Shema Israel, Yod He Vahe Eloheinu, Yod He Vahe Achad. Shema, hear. It also means the name, hear the name. Shema Israel. Israel is the struggle with God. If you hear the name Shema, you struggle. You struggle to believe, you struggle to embody, you struggle to embrace the possibility presented by the presence of the name. Shema Israel. Yud He Vav He is the creative name. Also called Adonai, Lordship. If I let this name be, in a certain sense, the Lordship, the place that I cooperate with, the place that I allow to direct my life. Yud He Vav He, Eloheinu. That God becomes the God in my heart, my God. Eloheinu means my God. So the embodiment of the divine, the direct experience of the divine in the heart, Eloheinu. Yud He Vav He, through the embodiment of the name, through the becoming, the divine becoming, in living in my heart, I become the speaker of the name, Yud He Vav He, with both the creative process of the name and the sovereign intelligence of that name. And what I speak into is Achad, unity, the oneness of things. Shema Israel, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Achad. Hear. The name is one. The world is one. We are one. The speaking of the name is the affirmation of unity. The practice of deep magic is the practice of unifying. It is the gathering together of the lost parts of ourselves and the lost parts of the world into the great bundle of the living. So that the idols of our nature become transparent, so that transparency of the magician is visible in all parts of our being. And through that transparency, we experience that living light and love that tells us we are at home. This is our house. The universe is our house. The universe is our home. We are at home. We are not in exile. We are not lost. So, we've got about 10 minutes before we break for our lunch. So let's see if there's any thoughts or questions about all that. Fern. Oh, you're gone. Oh, there you are. Hi, Fern.
Hello. Just kind of jumped into me in the last bit. I loved that talk, and it just felt like that's everything, in a way, the whole course, and why I feel like I'm doing this work, encapsulated into one. So it feels like there's so much there. And the particular tarot card and the magician. So I love the figure and I love the stance and the word magician. And there's something which I'm kind of feeling. No, it's the part of me that goes, I want it to be a genderless figure. In a way, yeah, like maybe art in the art card in the cloth pack. I kind of like that because it's about two things coming together. And it feels that there's something about, yes. I mean, I know the tarot comes from a history, a context, and everything else, but I'm kind of wondering how to claim that word for myself as well, to be a magician rather than say, oh, you can be a witch because you're a female.
I think magicians, and in fact, in some ways, I think that weight card it has a degree of androgyny about it. You know, it's and in some of the ways, one of the reasons I like that card is you can't easily tell from it actually is this masculine or feminine. It's a sort of, it doesn't got the art card has these obvious opposites combined inside itself, but there is a certain androgynous quality, I think, in the weight card. That you couldn't exactly tell if this is a male or a female. Flowing drapery, you know, the sort of the beardless face. So I kind of like that about that image of the card. But you're absolutely right. It's, you know, the whole, because actually, in a certain sense, the magician depends upon the quality of being able to combine both masculinity and femininity. That's the sense of opposites combined, flowing through the form somewhere. So in a way, that sense of being beyond gender and able to express any gender, any variety of gender, is kind of rather cool. That's the sort of fluidity, the creativity, the mercurial nature of the magician.
Could I say, I don't understand why you think the word magician is gendered in the slightest.
I'm wondering about... No, I mean, sometimes on some days it's not, and some days it is. I don't know, mages. Is the word mages kind of similar, or is there?
Well, it comes from the same root. I mean, basically, they come, the whole magus magician thing ultimately comes out of the traditions of Zoroastrianism. And the magi, so that's where we get the idea of the magi from. That they are gendered there. They come out of gender, so they are considered, the magi are male, the male fire priests of Zoroastrianism. And I mean, I agree with Penny. It's not, the name isn't intrinsically gendered, but typically magicians are depicted as bearded men very often. I mean, they don't have to be, obviously, but that's, if we look at, but culturally. The, you know, you think of images like Merlin, Dr. D, you know, culturally, you're much less likely to hear a woman described as a magician, much more likely to be called a witch, which I think is the cultural issue that I think that you're quite rightly identifying, really.
I'm sure this is really linguistically incorrect. Sure, it's probably really incorrect, but I always think that the ma is the ma in magus and magician, and also in al-masa, which is the messiah. I know, I just kind of use that in my own sort of weird imagination to like make things less gendered.
No, I think in a way that's what we have to do, isn't it? I think there's something about engaging with these cultural forms, and well, it's the same principle of unification, of taking something within a cultural form and looking at where does that form exclude, and how can we make that form more inclusive? How can we create it? Into, so it can be using the word ma, which is of course mother, divine mother, and if you like, infusing that phrase with that sense of the divine feminine. or can be whatever other way we do that. You know, I think because actually the whole point about this work is, of course, is that we, as we of course reach out to these archetypes of unification, simultaneously we notice the places of separation. That's exactly, you know, that's the practice in a certain sense. So as we look at the magician as the unifier, what we also see, well, what is left out, what is culturally. Ferd is right, I think, to say this, much more commonly you'll find men referred to as magicians, women more likely as witches. Now that's not universal at all, and the great 20th century magicians and before that who are women, but that's, the cultural edge, I think, that Ferd is leaning into a bit there, which I think is quite important. And of course it is important, this idea of remembering that as we touch into unification, of course we also enter into separation and splitting.
I was thinking about the in the meditation, the words... The meditation? No, it was in kind of looking at the card. Transmission.
Yeah.
And then transistor. And I don't know whether that's kind of what's happening
with
the transmission, and then there's something,
the transition. Well, trans is an interesting word, isn't it? I was just thinking that as you said it, because trans is about, well, it has that sense of moving beyond something, and it's so to transmit is to something to move from one place to another. What transistors do is a similar version of that. Transistors enable the movement from one state to another, from, if you like, electrical impulses into sound waves. And so there's something about this act of the movement from one state to another state, and what happens in that somewhere.
Could I mention something from my meditation,
which seems
to relate to that, which is that as we all started chanting the name in the temple, I found it impossible to stand still in the temple, and so I started moving to the different directions, and then I became, because the magician was in my mind, I became aware of the particular stance and its similarity to that of the whirling dervishes.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, going into a trance to connect the world and transmit something, and I felt that very keenly.
No, I think that's really spot on, because actually that's it's interesting you mentioned the dervishes, because actually that is exactly the same stance in movement, because in a sense what you know, it's kind of interesting what they do, because they, in a sense, their ceremony, which is absolutely about the embodiment of the spirit, just is a literal inaction of that stance of the magician, and they turn anti-clockwise because they're bringing the kind of the light down into matter, so moving starwise, and they, you know, that in fact, interestingly, their stance, their upward hand is their left hand, and their downward, so their stance is opposite the stance of the magician. I don't know why particularly, but certainly the experience, as I've practiced the whirl, and it's an extraordinary thing, because you have this sense of enormous movement, but at the center you're completely still. And you can only stay still if you remain centered on the center. If your attention goes out at all, you wobble and you fall over because you're kind of going quite fast. So it's just interesting.
They're making the Aleph.
Yeah.
With their arms.
Yeah.
So that's why it's the left and the right, because they're making the left.
Oh, yes, that's the way the Aleph. Well, that's completely right. That's where the Aleph moves, isn't it? Thanks. Yes, of course it is. Yeah.
And in that earlier picture of the magician, the Marseille one, it is the left hand up. It's the opposite hand.
Oh, I hadn't noticed.
Or it was when you showed it on the screen.
No, I'm sure it is. I'm sure that's right. Interesting. But anyway, the principal idea there is this kind of movement, the stillness and movement, and this combination of opposites, really, and sort of, and of course, what happens in your meditation, in the chant, is both that kind of movement, you know. So it's interesting, Ben.
Yeah.
Good.
Yes, and
for, can I just say? Oh, okay.
For me, you're talking us through the magician card. It's like that. I went into that place, and so when Faye said that about the you know, the gender bit, it took me back. It's like, oh, but the witch is something different. Oh, so the taking in, actually, I was then able to embody the magician without any query.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, good.
I was just going to say, when you were talking, and you were talking about the movement from the fire from Yod symbol in the south, and then to, if I got this correctly, then over to the west,
yep,
and the water,
yep,
and then to the east and the sword.
Yep.
And then finally to the north in the pentacle.
Yep.
I just became aware of that shape like the lightning flash.
Yes, that's right.
Make,
yep,
connection in my mind. I never thought of it like that before.
Yeah.
So it felt like the act of creation was,
yeah,
that lightning,
yep,
flash between the different elements and the symbols and the,
yep,
directions. So I just thought, well, maybe if I'm trying to create something, I should, something good, hopefully, I can kind of envisage that movement in those,
yeah,
different,
yeah,
directions and the,
yeah,
and the you know, the symbols that go with them. And then that just occurred to me when I was
No, it's right, absolutely spot on. It absolutely is the lightning flash. It's exactly that lightning flash of creation, bringing something new into the world, really. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So thank you. That sort of gave it some clarity.
Good. I'm glad. Good.
But could I just mention, I think you said something incredibly profound this morning, maybe you said a few things profound, something always strikes me, and this made me quite tearful, your talk after the meditation, about the house of the divine, and this idea, which I'd never thought about the place where the infinite becomes finite, then, as we become the pillar, first of all, from the infinite, we become the pillar, and then it's the way we gradually coalesce down,
yeah,
into this thing, this,
yeah,
thing that we see as ourselves.
Yeah.
And you seem to take that in stages, which I could, which made incredible sense to me, and really I found very moving. And I think that will be a very helpful meditation for me for the future, because what I was thinking of when you were talking about, you know, people who get mixed up in their own hypnotic things, I thought about the David Bowie song, which was, there's a phrase, and he says, "I turned myself to face me, but I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test." And you think of a cat chasing its tail,
yeah,
you
know, that's right,
trying,
yeah,
to,
yeah, yeah,
see what your own imperfections are and,
yeah,
all that,
yeah,
crap,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But you'll always fool yourself.
Yes, you will. No, totally.
And so,
yeah,
to go back to the infinite and feel to be the pillar and to step into the fire is just fantastic.
No, it's the way to do it. You can't easily do it the other way around, and that's why that's a brilliant song of his, that, actually, and it really shows the complication. It just brilliantly shows the complication of trying to do it that way, really. Whereas if you do it the other way, it just happens, and it's a different process altogether, really. Good. Okie dokie, guys, let's have a break for our lunch and come back at 1:30, and we'll see what happens next. Have a nice lunch, everybody.
Thank you.
Okay.